After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi everyone, it's Raghu Marcus, and I'm here today with somebody who is making a return to mind rolling, Tanisara, and today it's a solo outing, because last time you were with your husband and your teaching partner, Kitsaro.
That's correct, yes. I think it was about a year ago that we talked last.
That's right, yeah. And what, of course, prompted me, not that I need any prompting with you, because I love hanging out with you, is this new book, Time to Stand Up.
And, yes, indeed.
And it is a real call to action, by the way. No doubt about that. But let's quickly get into, I'd just like to really start with what prompted you, what inner urging was there for you? I'm sure this just didn't happen, it's not happenstance in the moment. So what were some of the events, maybe even in your life and through your life, that brought you to writing this book, which we'll obviously get into here?
It's hard to say exactly one thing. I mean, first of all, the catalyst was I was invited to write it, first of all, by as part of the Sacred Activism series of North Atlantic Books, which is a publisher that operates out of Berkeley. The Sacred Activism series is under the umbrella of the author and spiritual teacher Andrew Harvey, who has the Sacred Activism School. So this was a Buddhist contribution on that theme of engaging our times from a spiritual perspective. So that was really a major catalyst, obviously, to get me going on the book. But I think before that, the themes in the book had been bubbling away for quite a long time.
Because in some ways, it's a critique of Buddhism in its ability to really respond to the very dangerous times that we're in, or the inquiry into how Buddhism can respond by undertaking its own deep journey into its own shadow so that it could respond more fully. So that was one aspect, having been for four decades working within Buddhist structures. And also it was, I wanted to go back into the Buddha's life and look at examples of how the Buddha had been actually lived, not only as a realizer, but also as a sacred activist himself, how he'd engaged his society and undertaking really radical changes, structural changes, and challenged the status quo of the time. And then it also grew out of my own consideration about how could the Dharma speak to the issues of our time and throw some light on what's going on and offer some hope and way forward and way through these tremendously, this global crisis, which I see as we're in the midst of, that is the, you know, so the largest symptom of that is the catastrophe of the climate, of the climate situation.
So all of those threads were sort of there really in emerging the book, but it had to be written quite quickly. I didn't have a lot of time to write it, and I have to say, it was hard for me to feel that it was my book. I mean, I wrote it, and it's, and the themes in it are very familiar for me, and the inquiry in it, and the depth inquiry into the heart of some of the issues in the book, obviously came through me. But I felt it sort of downloaded almost. And unfolded in a very fluid way.
Mm. And it reads like that as well.
Oh, thanks.
But I think the critical thing here in this, which really got my attention, was the relationship. And of the feminine, obviously, is the central theme in this book. Certainly, infusing activism with spiritual truths is the core. But the, as you call it, the domain of the feminine, and related to our current times, and related to the traditional patriarchal hierarchy that... is, as you put it, slow to speak out in defense of the earth. And this isn't something that is talked about a lot, even by people who are very pro-environment, who, of course, know and understand what it is that we have been doing and what it is we are doing with our planet. And... some of this may seem overly simplistic in terms of the way that I'm expressing my delight, really, about how you've brought in this highly, highly important, these concepts around the feminine. And so just speak to that a little bit so that we can really understand the core of which you're giving a path that we should really think about related to what we are doing and how we are going about even thinking about making changes to stem what is going on right now.
Thank you for that, Raghu, because you actually really did encapsulate the heart of the book in a very clear way, which I appreciate, and you're right. Actually, underpinning everything I just said as an opening remarks is the acknowledgement and the devastation, really, of the loss. And I'm not talking about gender so much, because the feminine is within all of us, and it's like the depth, really, of soul, the soul. I see this feminine is represented as the depth of soul and the loss of that. And what I mean by that is that feeling not so much soul, and sometimes we use it as in a religious metaphor, but to understand that at the depth of our being, there's a deep interwovenness within all of life. And where we cease to see the world and people and living beings and the earth itself as an object to us that we're free to exploit or plunder or feel has no sentiency or sacredness. And the reclamation of the feminine really is the reclamation of this deep sense of ensoulment of all of life, and therefore the sacredness of all of life, and that it's that life isn't and other beings and the earth isn't an object, and we have no right to plunder this earth in the way that we're doing, and to keep extracting and decimating and other beings and sacrificing those that we think are less important to our agendas. And this comes out of a mental attitude, and that's supported to some degree by patriarchal, the patriarchy of the last few thousand millennia, which is expressed through all of the Axial Age religions, of which Buddhism is one, and all of the primary religions are also, where the sacred was began to be seen as apart from the materiality of life, you know, that the earth and the body and sexuality and all of these aspects of embodiment that we live with all the time were seen as lesser and were desold, if you like, as from the sacred. And in that sort of ripping out of that feeling of being in a web of life, which we felt at some very deep place or in very early, like indigenous people and early humans felt that, the sense of being very deeply interconnected, interwoven, and having a place and belonging in life, when, with the loss of all of that, and when the sort of focus of spirituality became some transcendent ideal that was sort of disembodied almost, there's been this sort of, I think partly from that wound, and partly from the complex feelings from that wound, that trauma of that wound, that ripping away, there's this sort of great sense of maybe, I don't know, that's what I explore in the book, is perhaps rage or lack of feeling with the earth and life itself, or insensitivity, violence. You know, there's so many things that come out of this loss of the sacred, this loss of the deep feminine. Mm. And there has, the journey therefore has to be both the reclamation of this loss, the reclamation of the feminine within insensitivity, receptivity, and intimacy with life within all of us, and at the same time the healing of the masculine within all of us, of that which has been brutalized, because in some ways the masculine also has been brutalized and shaped into a distorted form, where we now see this emergence of a power that dominates through political and corporate and the oligarchy that we have now. It's like the extremity of a patriarchy and a dominant consciousness that feels that its relationship to everything else is one of control based on fear.
Yeah. And as you say, feminine as central to awakening, is central to awakening, and not solely as gender, as you just said, but something that lives within each of us. And I think that that's a very important aspect of spirituality in general. The feminine energy is essential because of its natural receptivity, and I'm reading from the book, inclusivity and empathy, the feminine archetype of kind and careful nurturing that cares for the earth is so important now. But gee whiz, it's overwhelming. The aggression is overwhelming these days. And that's why when I read the book, and I just felt, oh my God, there's just, nobody's talking about this right now. Nobody is even addressing that reality. And then you get somebody, and I'm just moving off subject for a second, but it just occurs to me, and Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah, been thinking about her quite a lot today, funnily enough.
And all of this, everything that you're talking about, and a lot of the darkness that is going on in this world related to the environment, related to the war and terrorism and disparity of income and all of these things, which are really coming to a gigantic denouement, shall we say.
Yeah.
And then you see somebody like her and you go, okay, well, here's some hope where we have a woman who can provide what it is that you're talking about here. And yet it seems to be that part of who she is so diminished. I don't get that from her, you know.
No.
I get from her the power and the aggressiveness and the ability to get stuff done is the emphasis, but not in the real feminine. And probably because she's being told, stay away from anything like that, because that is just, you're going to get the opposite reaction. So I think that we just don't have archetypes to really share. And one of them that in the East we do, and one of them is the depiction of Avalokiteshvara, which is the, as you say, the perfect embodiment of empowered of balance. Talk about that. Talk about that deity as a real example that we could share, and I just wonder how the hell we can share it outside of the ism of Buddhism.
That's, you've just said so much. And firstly, I think what comes to my mind is how, and I will go talk to about Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, but firstly, what comes to my mind is that how the feminine women have to become masculine to compete on, and in some ways become even more hard. And I mean, what Hillary Clinton's had to go through is, you know, to get to the point that she is, you know, she has to have a skin like a, well, you know, like a rhinoceros. But I also, you know, one does have to wonder, I think it is important to engage politically. Absolutely, but will these changes that we really need come from political systems? I mean, that's what I'm wondering right now, or in how they're held anyway, with you know, with one person, sort of it's part of the patriarchy and hierarchy that you have this sort of pyramid, and then one person, these few people debating, you know, where the country should go, what should happen. And for me, it just feels the whole system should be in question, not so much the individuals. But that's a big subject, and I know we don't want to go there right now. You're asking about Avalokiteshvara, and this Avalokiteshvara is really a representation of our deepest heart, Kuan Yin. It's the bodhisattva in Buddhist metaphor, which actually grew out of the Indian mythology that predated Buddhism, but it represents the depth of wisdom, seeing precisely into the nature of profound emptiness and therefore profound fullness and interconnectedness and intimacy of all things. And because of that, there is the depth of compassion. It means that this heart is both deeply, you can't quantify the fundamental consciousness, pure consciousness, which is what another way of talking about heart. You can't quantify that in any particular way, shape, form, in time. It's immeasurable, it's unmoving, it's ever-present. And then when realized, you realize that it's profound. We say it's empty. It's only empty because it's, 'cause nothing outside of it. So it's full. Everything is within this heart. And when we understand within this consciousness, there's no ultimate separation. The separations come through designation of thinking and perception. And so when that collapses, and we're inducted into reality, realizing that actually all beings, all things are part of our own oneness together here. And that realization is just changes the whole picture, because then why would you trash what is a part of yourself? Why would you do that? Why would you kill another when you're killing a part of yourself? You wouldn't. And so that's the realization we need to really awaken into, that realization and the activity or the practice of Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara to arrive into that understanding is through in-depth listening. which is a meditative practice, to listen beyond and beneath all the perceptions, all the views, all the judgments, until you hear your heart, hears the heart of all beings. You hear the sound of all beings within your own presence, and you're listening from a place of compassion. So that's the practice of that. But, you know, talking about masculine and feminine, I've been wondering about that, whether that's a bit problematic, because people get so, I mean, it is important to name these territories because of the imbalance and the patriarchy, etc. But people get then so caught up, like you're talking about Hillary Clinton, and we think, oh, she's a woman, but, you know, what does that really mean? Is she displaying those qualities of femininity, or is it sort of, you know, one's just looking at gender. So I'm wondering, I'm beginning to wonder whether one should be talking about right and left hemispheres of the brain.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to sort of de-gender the discussion.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the dominance of the left brain with its sort of naming and categorizing and its sense of being in time and logic and rationale, all of which we rely on heavily, and all of which is a very powerful shaping of our culture. But then, you know, you go to the right brain, it's more intuitive, it's more connected, it's timeless, it's more instinctual in a way, more creative. So I'm wondering if there's other metaphors that we can talk into, as well as, and to complement the masculine and feminine metaphor, so people don't get so stuck on the gender aspect.
Yeah. And even further to this part of the conversation, in the book, you say the power of the feminine is in her receptive formlessness, which she trusts as a natural source of intuitive truth, which is just what you were talking about. And also, because she has been shrouded for centuries in patriarchal conditioning, particularly within a masculine paradigm, she doesn't trust her deepest knowing. And that, again, just as you just said, let's forget about gender. Let's talk about that in each one of us. That we we are not trusting our deepest knowing, and that just occurs to me as a big wow, huh?
It is a big wow, because, you know, there are other ways of knowing than knowing through logic and rationale and linear designation, and, you know, we have deified the rationale. We have deified science going into the objective world and sort of to the point of crashing particles together to try and really explode what is the inside of matter, you know, so like torturing nature to find out the building blocks of matter. But I don't think it's the right, well, maybe it's that direction is taking us back into consciousness, because I think there's a whole other way of knowing that's very intimate, and it is the way of unknowing, of stripping away all the things that we think we know, and then going into that deep listening and presence and receptivity. And that way of knowing starts to connect us into this intimacy experience, the intimacy with all life. It's not outside of this one consciousness, you know, and what is known, and the knowing starts to merge. And that's a very wow kind of, you know, okay. Explodes everything. How can we, do that on a more collective? I mean, we do that individually. We've been doing that on our meditation cushions, but, you know, how can we translate that out?
And sometimes I think also, even on our meditation cushions, we get, and you talk about this in the book, a little, it extends to self-interest. Our self-interest about ourselves becoming free and leaving out the compassion part and thinking about somebody aside from yourself. And so here's the one ingredient, just to move this to another area. Not really, but you tell a story in this book. And to me, it's a darshan. And it's when you went to the Mahabodhi temple in Bodh Gaya. And and it relates to all your perceptions of the Buddha. And many people, we all have had this perception of the Buddha, these perceptions of the Buddha. Do you remember the story? I'd love for you to tell it.
Yes. Well, you know, I trained in a very Thai forest school of Ajahn Chah, and it's quite a sort of, what's the word? It's a warrior school, and I talk about that, the shift from the warrior metaphor to the lover, but it was a very warrior school, and there was a sense of sternness, really, and discipline and renunciation and letting go and the Vinaya that the Buddha left and these texts, these very old texts, incredible texts that are recorded from the Buddha's teaching, but they're very dry, extremely dry. And the Buddha often, I mean, he actually has humor and he does sort of, you know, come over sometimes in that mode, but more often there's a certain sternness. And so I suppose my internalized sense of the Buddha, and it was my own projection, was probably like a bit of like a stern father figure that one felt would probably be going tut tut at your thoughts, or you know, not good enough, or you know, there was these sort of idealized saints from the, you know, that you know, this master would sit and wouldn't move for a week, or this one would be, you know, fasting, or this. So I had all these internalized metaphors of what spiritual life was, and some of them not that conscious. But at that moment when I went to Buddh Gaya, that was in 1992 with my partner Kitty Saro. Oh, no, sorry, that wasn't. That was earlier. It was earlier when I was a nun, I think. Or was it? Was anyway, doesn't matter. The point was, when I went into the central inner shrine of the Maha Bodhi Temple, it's chaotic in there. People are sort of throwing flowers and money and incense at the big Buddha statue, and there's people doing chants, and all sorts of things are going on there. And I felt very sort of somewhat agitated by this whole. I had this idea that there should be sort of more reverence, and it was actually, you know, wasn't that, it's India, you know, it's all over the place. But at a certain point, I found my mind just opening up. I think I bowed some point. It was just bowing, and my mind just sort of somehow just this shift happened, and it was like something cracked open, and I experienced this sense of tremendous. First of all, a sense of being accepted. It was a very profound feeling, but then what I felt in that is a sense of acceptance. And it didn't feel like it came from my own psychodynamic material. It really felt like some darshan, as you say. I felt this tremendous sense of love. And it was an important moment for me because I understood that the Buddha, what I really was, sort of the transmission that was this tremendous love that the Buddha had for me, you know, sounds a bit sort of, but for all humanity, I just felt like this is what his journey and his teaching and his, and you know, 40 years of turning the wheel of the Dharma, profoundly he moved from a place of love. And that was really helpful to feel, because then it dissolved all those sort of rather stern images that I'd internalized and then projected onto myself. And it's really important that we come to this love, you know, that this journey of human life is not about attaining great feats of enlightenment or becoming conquering everything, and how we internalize that and project that onto the spiritual life or conquering this earth. We have to learn to love, you know, we have to learn this spiritual life has to bring us in this very human way, in this very human potential, to the place where we can truly accept, you know, in a very deep way. So this is something that I would like to aspire to. Because it's not easy. It's not easy, is it? It's not easy, you know, especially in this furnace that we're now in, when one can so quickly move into hatred and judging. And I get so upset about, you know, the travesty that's happening on our planet. Mm. And the psychopathic mindset that's generating it. But we're all woven into this same reality, so...
Yeah, It's very difficult. We talk about this on the podcast all the time with different people. I just the other day went through this with somebody, and we're always confronting that same issue of anger, of judgment, of hate.
Yes.
We're doing what it is that we're fighting back against. So I think the antidote is this story, is this getting to this place of love, not just practicing so that we can become free. It's practicing so that we can share that love and be able then to really, you call it deep listening, and I know that's a Buddhist practice. So that deep listening and that intuitive knowing is not possible in my mind without that love. This for me was first experience, the unconditional love, as you know, because we talked about it before, and it was with Neem Karoli Baba when Ram Dass and a number of us went back to India with him the second time. And I'll tell you, his emphasis on the feminine was so, so strong.
Wow.
He would say to us over and over and over, every woman that you see, you should love as you love your mother and your sister. He would in the most simplistic terms, yet they were so profound in those moments. Mm. But they turned us inside in a way that we hadn't been turned inside to realize that, and then continued to realize that, or at least work on that. It's a little too aggrandizing to say we realized that we were just kids and we didn't realize it. But it gave us a path to work on. And so in reading your book and reading about and how you codify the feminine within each of us, it really brought me back to that place. It was just it's just been absolutely wonderful. Now there's some tough stuff in this book. I mean, you have a chapter called When the Devil Shows Up, which is basically, for me, the pralaya, right?
Yeah.
And it's the time is ripe for transformation and waking up that has the potential to create a new world. And obviously, when you have individual suffering, those are the times at which we can wake up individually. And now we have this gigantic collective suffering. And it is a pretty huge wake up call, and many people, of course, are very concerned and certainly thinking about it. And one of the things that I loved was a chapter called "Call of the Earth," and you talk about the indigenous people and what they have to offer us, and you talk about the Kegi message and Aluna. Can you talk about that? And I know there's a doc called Aluna, which I think I would love to see, and I would suggest it to everybody. The way that but tell us a little bit more about it and the Kegi and that message.
And firstly, thank you for mentioning Maharaji. It's wonderful to be connected with that tremendous, profound love, because I do think we need examples to hold that light. And I was also thinking, I'm talking to you from South Africa, where I work a lot and live a lot of the time, and I was thinking of Mr. Mandela as exemplifying that same, demonstrating that love through the fire of his journey and the journey here that happened. In terms of the Kogi message, that was something I came across when I very earlier on, maybe 1991, when I first heard about them and their training and their coming out. They live in which South American country? So I should know this. I wrote about it. But anyway, they came out to, they live a pre-Columbian lifestyle. That means like before the colonization that happened over the last 500-600 years across the globe at the hands of primarily Europeans, and decimated many of the First Nation peoples in here in Africa, the Khoisan, or the in South America, in Australia, and of course in America, and this terrible, terrible trauma that happened against the peoples that had, they knew about, they lived and knew this deep, deep relationship within the earth. They were in the web of life. And they also had a sense of relationship not only with the earth, but a cosmological relationship with the skies, the heavens, the animals. Everything was a speaking, it was a speaking world. That means everything is sacred, everything is alive, everything is in a communication. And in that process, there's great revelation and depth of opening and awareness. So it's a whole reality, and there's a whole sort of way of being in that reality that that gives great meaning and great placement and great belonging. All of that was with the outward decimation of the First Nation people. We decimated that within ourselves, including the sense of reverence for nature and wildness, and not really that nature wasn't really wild. It's only wild to us as it was actually very intimate for First Nation peoples. The Kogis have come out. They, I think in Colombia, forgive me, it's a bit late at night and my brain's a bit fried today, but they came out of their lifestyle to give this message to humanity saying, you haven't got long. This is in 1991. This is your big brother talking to the little brother saying, you know, you're messing this up. This is going really wrong. So then they've come out now, just recently, I think last year, and come out now with another message, to pretty similar. But in that message, and what I record in the book is quite interesting. Again, saying that everything is speaking to everything else. So when you destroy, when you mine a piece of land, you don't understand that you're completely interrupting the energy flow, say, of the relationship between the forest and the ocean and that land that you've mined and destroyed. And it damages this sort of connection within nature of which we're a part. So every piece of nature that we damage, we're damaging our own psyche as well. And they're saying that actually for this evolutionary process that the human mind is a part of it, and we're needed as a conduit to help this evolutionary process unfold itself. But we do that better when we're actually tuned in and respectful and honoring of the sacredness of this evolutionary process manifested through nature and matter. We're a part of this journey. We've removed ourselves from it as an observer, and we feel arrogant. We feel we're above this. And I think what we need to do is we need to actually be very humble in relationship to First Nation people, acknowledge a terrible decimation, and seek their guidance, because these are peoples that never forgot their profound relationship with the mother. They never did, we did. Yeah. But they've carried that and preserved that, and they're marginalized and been waiting, some of them waiting for us to wake up enough. And this is the moment when we say, you know, please lead us, because we clearly shouldn't be leading at this moment.
Clearly. And they say, a quote here is that this energy is the source of all life and intelligence, and is also the mind inside nature. That's quite something. The mind inside nature that is thinking, self-aware, and very much alive.
Exactly.
That's what a great quote. So this chapter, Call of the Earth, and I just thought to myself, that's versus our call to technology, separation, and fear. That's what seems to have been our call. Technology is so fantastic. Here we are, we're doing this podcast. You're in South Africa and I'm in the eastern seaboard of the United States, and we're able to do this, and then we're able to share this worldwide through the auspices of digital technology. How beautiful. And at the same time, there's a way in which we use this technology as an isolation device. And that is brings many, many, many difficulties. So it really is a mixed bag. There's something else here that I've got to get in because, again, it's tremendously important. It's the exchange that you write about between Buddha and the Brahma, I guess the Brahmana god, Sampati. It's tremendously important. Can talk about it a little bit, and I have some comment about it, but I want to hear from you first.
Yeah, this is a moment when Brahma Sahampati, is a god from the Brahma realm, comes down. The Buddha's about, he's awakened, he's seen, realized what's called the Amata Dharma, the deathless Dharma. He's seen, he's sort of cracked open the nugget, really. He's seen the co-arising of what gives rise to this suffering sense of separate self that caught in its own delusions. And he's sort of resolved this massive quest of what is it that doesn't die. And he realizes there's a deathless element. He's in this profoundly blissful and peaceful. So he's done this great journey. And then he thinks it's too subtle to teach. You know, it's too difficult. This world is caught in the veil of illusion and delusion and fear and greed and hatred and all the things we're talking about. And he's about to give up. And at that point, you know, the Devic realm, the angelic kingdom, who appear a lot in the Buddha suttas, as we're just talking First Nation reality, and as in older culture, Celtic cultures and things like that, this is a real part of the cosmological part of the fullness of reality, that there are subtle beings that interact with this plane. So anyway, they're cheering on the Buddha, and this is great, but then they suddenly see he's about to give up, and they can't let him not share what he's discovered. This would be a massive loss, and they know this. So Brahma, Sahampati, he comes from the Brahma realm, which represents the sort of bringing the creation, bringing into form. You know, this is you're awakening, but the fullness of awakening is to bring your message into form. You can see it, but to learn to embody it and demonstrate it in the world. This is then the fully awakened Buddha. So Brahma Sahampati appears before the Buddha and says, you know, please, there are those with a little dust in their eye, and for want of not hearing the Dharma, they will not have the opportunity to awaken. Please go forth and turn the wheel of the Dharma. So this is a symbol, really. It's a symbol of compassion that the Buddha feels, you know, or it's also a real intervention of the divine, which I actually think is something we need to really also open to, that we need this, we have to understand that this, with all our technology, it's not going to solve it, really. I think we still think that this human mind on the rational plane is going to solve this unbelievable crisis that we've created, that we're going to solve it from the same place from where we created it from, this extreme rational control of the material realm, even though in the subtle realms of technology. But if there isn't this depth that we're talking about, infused by the sacred, infused by wisdom, infused by this quality of what we might call divine humility, then, you know, we're not going to really heal and survive. So this, the divine is the unknown. It's the unexpected. It's the moment when you don't know what's going, but you just open in a prayerful way, and that then allows something else, an intuitive, like a Maharaji, love, or an Einstein, a radical shift of quantum understanding. It's that kind of space, because you're tuning into the deepest intelligence, that allows for shifts to happen. And so this is an important archetypal moment in the Buddha's life. Without that moment, we wouldn't have had, you know, this extraordinary gift of the Buddha and his exquisite teaching.
The sharing.
The sharing. You wouldn't have that exactly. Sharing.
And say the wheel of the Dharma must be turned out of compassion for living beings and to evolve the world. That to me is the most central statement of this whole book. Just because without that, if we are not doing that, what purpose do we have to be on this planet? Mm-hmm. This sharing our compassion, sharing our loves, sharing our wisdom, whatever it is, it stemmed from this this story. That's why I love this story of the Buddha's impulse to do that.
You framed that beautifully. That's absolutely right.
There's we're getting close to the end of the podcast, but there's something here that I just want to ask you about, because I'm not completely clear about it. And it's about the pitfall of enlightenment. Is the focus on the goal of awakening rather than maturing awakening in daily life? Now, we've touched on this a little bit in terms of not, and you do in your book quite a bit, we cannot be focused on our personal freedom without being focused on, as the Bodhisattva vow, on freedom for everyone. But in this particular thing, awakening, right, the mature awakening in daily life, just expand on that, would you?
When many of us started off on this journey, we had perhaps very profound openings. We talked in the last podcast about the, you know, some of that was evoked through the use of psychotropic plants or through maybe various other means. One has a very sudden or deep opening, or one's inspired by the ideal of enlightenment. But what happens is then one holds an ideal or holds a memory, or and it sort of obscures the ordinariness of so-called ordinariness of daily life, and we can start to feel everything else that's not presenting in this sort of enlightened metaphor that we have an ideal about, isn't it? And in that process, we actually miss the actual teaching in each moment. The Dharma is always here and now in everything. Everything is teaching us all the time. You know, the mundane, the headache, the conflict, the struggle, it's all part of the journey. It's all part of our awakening. So I think at some point, one has to go through a period of disillusionment. And maybe this, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking maybe, you know, this also has to happen, I think, on a global scale, disillusionment with our structures, you know, with the political, religious, and so on, that are infused with unrealistic expectation and idealism. And then we have to somehow return to it's not that we shouldn't hold an ideal or have a guiding light, but that has to relate and inform the actuality of the journey. And it's the journey that we undertake that is the maturing of awakening and integration of awakening in all aspects of our life. And that's a big deal. You know, you can have, I mean, in the Buddhist map of awakening, you have very profound awakenings. But you might not have even begun to purify greed, hatred, you know, greed and delusion and aversion. You know, so then there's still work to do. and then when you realize that, then actually everything becomes part of the awakening. And so that when one of the fruits of an awakened heart is to be in touch with the world, but not shaken and overwhelmed by that world. The Buddha called it the unshakable deliverance of heart. Well, you know, that heart is in touch with the world. We're not denying, we're not trying to hide away. Our enlightenment isn't hiding away. But we engage, but we allow ourselves to feel and be with what's happening, but we're not overwhelmed and shaken up. We see it for what it is, but are able to fully respond from a place of authenticity and empowerment and wisdom and compassion. But, you know, so when we hold the journey like that, it allows us to live our human life and respect every part of it.
Yeah. And here's another, my final quote here from the book, where you talk about the, and of course this is a directly referential to what you just said, we talk about the collective dark night of the soul that transcends all boundaries. And I don't think people need to look very far to see the truth of that, unfortunately. But fortunately, because yet we are awakening into knowing a deeper truth of being the one as many. You could have said of seeing the one as many, but being the one. And this is so directly a reference from our good friend Ram Dass, who talks of nothing these days but being love, being the one, and recognizing yourself in absolutely everything, from he calls it from the trees to the rug, and he has a whole story about this horrible dirty rug. I love the rug, you know, in a hotel ballroom, and people go, "You love the rug more than you love me." You know, it's this whole funny thing, and he talks about, yes, the manifestation of the many is only possible through realizing the one, and this is so beautifully said. A wonderful book. Wonderful book. Mm.
Thank you so much, Raghu, and that's a beautiful place to pause. May it be so for you and for all of and for me, for all of us. May we flower into that realization.
Yes. So time to stand up. It's a real call to action, and it has so much profundity of ideas and. There are some tough things in here too. I mean, I got caught. Let me tell you, I got caught by that. I couldn't, I'll be honest, I could not read it. It was the chapter on animal holocaust. And I guess not that I'm different than anybody. You know, I've got a bunch of dogs here right now. And I've always been an animal lover my whole life. And that was a tough read. That was a tough one.
Yeah, that's the most haunting piece for me, to tell you the truth.
I bet. Can't even imagine you writing that. So, but there's hope, and that hope is certainly exemplified in so many different ways, and so many different archetypes, and certainly the feminine archetype being the most important one, and something that we can all bring into our own lives, because that's where it starts. It's from each of our hearts to the next heart, to the next heart, to the next heart. So give us a little bits of website and information, how people can be in touch with you, can get with your books and teachings and so on.
Well, we have a website which is our little hermitage in South Africa, and through there you can write to us, and it'll get sent on to me. It's dharmagiri.org, Dharma, Dharma, Giri, Giri, that's one word, Giri is mountain, Sanskrit, dharmagiri.org.
And the book, of course, is available everywhere. Go to Amazon. And as we say whenever we're talking about people's books and so on, you go to Amazon and buy that book through our MindPod Network link, everybody. And you already know, because I go on about this every week. It helps support what we're doing. And but on its own merits, Time to Stand Up. So just go ahead and get that, and get it on any of your devices as well. I got it on my iPad. So thank you so much for this again.
Thank you.
I always so enjoy being with you. And last time you were here in the States, so it seemed like
you were
much closer. And now that you're in South Africa, it's like, wow, this is amazing.
It's like you're sitting in the front room.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, just our living room, God's living room. All right. All the best to you. And everybody, go to mindpodnetwork.com and go to Mind Rolling. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.